The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, after Palace fire Patrick Vieira on St. Patrick's Day, Prince Andrew concerned for his future on April the 1st. We ask, are the Eagles really reappointing Roy? How will he go down with the fans? And will it be on the final day against Nottingham Forest? We've all the Premier League news. Spurs manager putting the Conte into controversial. And his own surname as well. Plus, FA Cup, Mariners undone by seagulls like a budget Coleridge update, and a big haul for Haaland. It's the Totally Football Show. Unbelievable. Monday, the 20th of March, everyone, which is very exciting news, as is the fact that our lineup today features Daniel Storey. Hi, Daniel.
Good morning, James.
Nick Miller's with us as well. All right, Nick.
Hello, James.
And our go-to Welshman for the French view on things, Tom Williams. All right, Tom.
Hello, James.
Tom, I can't help but notice that you're not Amitai Winehouse.
I am not Amitai Winehouse. I am a last-minute replacement. But Amitai has sent me all of his most deeply held opinions on football. So I will be so anything controversial I say, any fans who get rattled, it's actually Amitai who is speaking through me as his mouthpiece.
Ooh,
just to clarify that at the start.
An update of your Twitter bio, all opinions
actually belong to Amitai Winehouse.
Right.
Please send
and
all
funny voices
his
as
way.
Well. Those were Amitai's, definitely.
Try and cut down on those as far as possible.
Dom Fifield should be joining us later, but he's been promoted, so I don't know. I hope so, because he's going to be talking to us about one of the many big stories this weekend. Yeah, just ahead of the season break for the internationals, the scriptwriters have thrown in lots of juicy twists and cliffhangers, to keep our interest piqued.
Yeah, just in case we forget about football over that time.
Yes. All right. Daniel, you had a busy weekend?
Yeah, I was at Arsenal yesterday to watch the latest kind of Bukayo Saka joy season. I think I've decided he's now, whatever happens, he's going to be my player of the year.
Is he?
Yeah, he's just such a joy to watch him. Like, it doesn't matter. Whenever he creates a goal, he sort of looks really expectantly like he's for someone to come and hug him and say thank you. And when he scores a goal, he sort of immediately sprints to whoever has played a pass in the move and just gives him a big hug. And yeah, I love that.
Positivity. Who's your player of the season then, Nick?
Well, it was Odegaard, but I'm now going towards Saka as well.
Really?
Yeah, because it...
Not just for Arsenal, I mean just out of all of football, Saka, is it?
Yeah, I think so. Because, I mean, it's partly because he's such a kind of likeable guy that I often wonder whether that kind of colours your opinion of him as a player. And then, you know, I think he's the only player in the Premier League in double figures for both goals and assists this season.
Yeah, I mean, that's
which is, you know.
Yeah.
But so it is quite reassuring when he is so brilliant. You're not just a fan of him because he's a likeable young man.
All right. Tom, are you going to plump for an utter bastard?
Yes, potentially. Well, I mean, if Arsenal win the league, it would, of course, be fitting for an Arsenal player to be Footballer of the Season. But if Erling Haaland ends up with, 79 goals, how can he not be Footballer of the Year?
And you say 79, but it's not impossible, Tom.
Mm.
Not impossible. All right, well, he was active, of course, as many players were, in the FA Cup quarterfinals this weekend. Let's start today's show with those.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network and sponsored by LiveScoreBet. You can get the latest football betting odds at livescorebet.com. It's over 18s only. Please bet responsibly and begambleaware.org.
FA Cup quarterfinals saw Brighton smashing Grimsby by 5 goals. Man City, though, going one louder with 6-0. Their victory against Burnley and Vincent Kompany. Their aggregate score over the last 11 meetings, you ask? Well, we'll come to that very shortly. A City next up in the semi-finals will be facing Sheffield United after the Blades saw off Blackburn in a spirited matchup, 3-2 that finish, while Brighton get Man United, who were 3-1 winners over Fulham after a remarkable final 15 minutes at Old Trafford.
It's a red card for someone on the Fulham bench. Penalty kick. As well, who's kicked off big style.
Man United 3, Fulham 1. All four of United's FA Cup games this season have been 3-1 wins at Old Trafford, curiously enough, but none of the others, I would venture to suggest, had the final 15 minutes that this one had. Daniel, Fulham were 1-0 up with about 15 minutes to go, and then what happened?
Then Willian handballed on the line, And it was in his defence, it was quite a subtle version of the art. But in an age of VAR, was obviously always going to be spotted, and he got a red card, and he looked kind of, he was sort of hanging around like a batsman who knows he's edged it, but is just going to wait for the DRS anyway, and started to walk off, and that was fine. And then Fulham sort of, well, they completely lost the plot. I mean, literally completely lost the plot. Marco Silva lost his head. Alexander Mitrovic definitely lost his head. Sort of barged into the referee, pushed his arm. He gets a red card. Marco Silva gets a red card. And I don't know, Fulham have had this brilliant season, and they have been a quite sort of passionate, emotional team at times. And that is Marco Silva as a manager. But they played really well against Man United. They'd had Willian sent off, but they might have still won the game. And yet they basically sacrificed their chance of a trophy to just have a massive tantrum, a shared tantrum as well. And I mean, the remarkable aspect of the incident for me is that it was the most obvious red card you'd see. So, you know, this was not, you know, a huge controversy. I mean, maybe they were annoyed about a couple of decisions that went against them in the first half, but it was extraordinary to see. And at that point, Manchester United just sort of thought, well, Fulham have lost their heads and they're not really playing, so we'll go and get to Wembley.
Well, indeed. 3-1, it finishes. Nick, had they been unfairly treated by Chris Kavanagh in the build-up?
I mean, no more than, you know, any other sort of vaguely contentious decisions in any other game. They seem to have got this kind of odd complex about Chris Kavanagh. There's the reference. Marco Silva, after the game, while saying, probably we shouldn't have all done that, then went on to say something about, you know, Chris Kavanagh having... I think he said something along the lines of that, where they have a difficult past.
Right. There's a couple of games in particular that Chris Kavanagh's officiated on that Fulham feel they didn't get the rub of the green. What did Marco Silva actually do then? Because he managed to get his red card before Kavanagh had even got to the pitch side monitor.
Yeah, very impressive. I mean, it's very kind of efficient implosion. Three red cards in the same over the same incident is pretty impressive. But yeah, Kavanagh went over to the VR monitor to be seemingly greeted by Marco Silva, who said something. He was asked afterwards what he said, and he said, "I can't remember," but he basically wasn't saying, "Well done, right. Referee, have a nice day."
I see.
That was enough for him to get sent off before Willian and then Mitrovic.
And if you are going to have three people sent off in the same match, it kind of makes sense to have them all sent off in the same minute, because you only have to make one readjustment. Mm. So, you know, there's that at least.
Big absences, though, for the Cottagers when the football returns. Willian, Mitrovic, manager. James Kerwin asks, with refereeing numbers in football at an all-time low, if the Pob were in charge of disciplinary proceedings, how big a suspension should Mitrovic receive to set an example to other players?
I mean, quite a big one. I mean, we discussed this on the pod when Bruno Fernandes shoved the linesman in the defeat at Liverpool, and that was a pretty gentle shove.
He didn't get anything.
He didn't get anything.
Nothing.
And you know, I think all of us were slightly surprised by that. And you know, the obvious comparison is Paolo Di Canio pushing Paul Alcock. And although this was sort of shoving rather than a frontal push, I almost felt there was more aggression to what Mitrovic did than what Di Canio did. There was something kind of petulant and a bit silly about Di Canio shoving Alcock in the kind of famous slow motion toddle backwards before he fell over, whereas Mitrovic is really, really aggressive with him. And of course, Marco Silva has come out and defended him, as you'd expect, but particularly in the context of violence being on the rise against officials at grassroots level, you know, I think the FA has to give him a fairly hefty punishment, because, I mean, it probably goes without saying, but you can't go around manhandling match officials. Had the decision been remotely controversial, you might have understood some of the frustration a little bit. But as Daniel was saying, the fact that it was just a nailed-on penalty and a nailed-on red card, there's no justification for the anger in the first place, and there's never any justification for putting your hands on a referee.
Daniel? I mean, anything you want to add to that, or does Tom just nailed it there?
Yeah, Tom nailed it. I mean, the culture is getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And it was only a matter of time before the verbal abuse and the kind of mad conspiracy theory corruption mania on social media ended up in this. So, yeah, I agree. We have to deal with this incident seriously. Otherwise, there will just be further escalation.
All right. Could be a lengthy ban for Mitrovic. United, meanwhile, continue to chase their cup treble dream. You'll have seen that last Friday they got drawn with Sevilla in the Europa League quarterfinals. Sevilla, who on one hand are having a dismal season and are kind of mixed up with the relegation battle in La Liga, but on the other hand are, well, Sevilla. And every single time they've ever qualified for the last eight, they've gone on to lift it. So, Meanwhile, an evocative semi-final awaiting in the FA Cup. They're up against Brighton, just like in the final 40 years ago. Who remembers that?
Yeah, vividly remember it. I think I was about 2 months away from being born.
Right.
I was about 5 months away from being born.
Daniel, where were you, gestationally speaking?
Minus 2.5 years.
All right, there you go. Listener, in case you were similarly not in a position to watch this, this is what it sounded like.
Robertson going forward strong. He's inside the Manchester United penalty area. He finds Smith, and Smith must score, and he hasn't scored, and Bailey has saved it.
Tom, we've all heard the clip, but what does that actually mean?
So it's the 1983 FA Cup final. Brighton, the underdogs, against favourites Manchester United. Very entertaining game. It's poised at 2-2, and Brighton's Gordon Smith finds himself one-on-one with Man United goalkeeper Gary Bailey, and the radio commentator Peter Jones utters the immortal line, and Smith must score. And he puts it straight at Gary Bailey. Does not score. 2-2 final score. Goes for a replay. United win 4-0. And that was the moment. I think there's now a Brighton fanzine called And Smith Must Score. Right. But the most curious thing about it is that it kind of went down in history as a kind of, you know, one of the great FA Cup final misses. But it's actually, I mean, I'd love to know what the XG is. If anyone can retrospectively give me an XG value for that chance. Because he's kind of in the middle of the goal with the goalkeeper very well positioned, and he puts it straight at him. There have been, I mean, plenty worse misses in FA Cup finals. I think without that line of commentary, I'm not sure it would have attained the status that it did.
Right. Solly Marsh in that position. Mitoma in that position.
I mean, in current form.
Yeah.
Back of the net before you can blink.
Before you can say Peter Jones. There you go. Brighton, of course, scoring 5 goals in their cup quarter-final this Sunday as they ended Grimsby's remarkable run. Well done to Grimsby Town for getting this far, but what a remarkable season that Brighton are having, Nick.
Extraordinary. I mean, and, you know, obviously people talk a lot about their ability to lose players and then just seem to bizarrely get stronger.
Regen.
Yeah. Evan Ferguson, the child giant striker, he looks incredible. I mean, he's his finish for, I think it was the second goal. Just this almost Bergkampian first touch, and then
he had a touch of the Ibra, I thought.
Yeah, but just this in astonishing composure for, well, I was going to say a man. He technically a man, but almost a child. It's incredible stuff.
All right. Daniel, you a fan?
Yeah, massively. I messaged a friend of mine who's a Brighton fan yesterday and sort of Declan Rice-esque question mark. Has he got an English grandfather? Is this Harry Kane's? They won't thank me for that. And he has already played twice for the senior side. So I think he is very Irish, unfortunately, for England. But he looks the business.
Right. Seagulls have scored 51 goals now in 25 games under Roberto Di Zerbi, which, given their preceding goal-scoring form, is pretty remarkable stuff. De Zerbi, of course, suspended for this after his own disciplinary issues.
Weird considering Brighton have the joint fewest cards given to anyone in the Premier League, but their manager has managed to get himself suspended after what has been there 6 months.
Yeah, he's had 4 yellow cards. Good stuff. Well, 5 is nice, but City went all the way up to 6 with their clash against Burnley. No happy return to the Etihad for Vincent Kompany, of course. That aggregate score that I mentioned before, well, it's now 11 straight defeats that Burnley have had against Man City in all competitions. Aggregate score, Nick?
Is it 40-1?
Yes. They've scored 1 goal and conceded 40, which, you know, given that they're due to be in the Premier League next season, will make for some interesting viewing.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have talked about it. Burnley, obviously, thoroughly pumped here, but the change under Vincent Kompany this season has been extraordinary.
Okay. Erling Haaland, though, even more extraordinary. Picking up in this game his 6th hat-trick for City, taking his tally to 42 goals for the season, 8 in just the last 2 matches. He's got, I mean, pick your stat here. Here's one that I've not heard before. He's got an incredible 6 hat-tricks in his debut season in English football. To put that in context, Sergio Aguero, in 10 years, got 12. Haaland's already got 6. Mad. Have we ever seen anything like Erling Haaland? Ever?
Genuinely, not since Dixie Dean.
Right.
Who, if we were to calculate how old we were when he was around, we would be
not
here
even I was
for,
born.
For not even you were born, James. But yeah, I mean, it is in the Premier League era at least,
yeah.
And we are rapidly running out of Premier League era stats in the sense that the record for goals in all competitions for a player in the Premier League era is 44, which jointly held by Ruud van Nistelrooy and Mo Salah, and Erling Haaland is 2 goals off that already.
Yeah, with at least 13 games still to play.
Yeah, in mid-March. So, yeah, we're going to have to delve back into the pre-Premier League era to see how he tallies up to, you know, to some of the goal-scoring greats. But, yeah, it's I kind of feel like, you know, we've seen players score 30 goals in English top flight seasons in recent years, but that 40 goal mark is much rarer, and he's already, you know, powering through that. So it's he's on track for something absolutely absurd.
And
yeah,
he's scored again. I mean, he's scored against Arsenal, Spurs, Liverpool, Manchester United, Newcastle this season. He's not just kind of bullying little teams.
Do you fancy his chances against Sheffield United then, who City will be playing in the next round, the semi final? Daniel Story.
Yeah, I mean, yes, obviously I do, because Erling Haaland. But I was just thinking, I can't, other than the goals I've seen him score in the last week, I can't really remember an Erling Haaland goal from this season. And
really?
He scored loads. That's like a really unerring thing whereby he's kind of, they're all sort of similar in that he's right place, right time, generally a one-touch finish. But there's, I can't really remember any of them. Maybe that's because he scored so many that I'm just like, yeah, there's 2 more, 3 more, 4 more, 5 more.
The João Cancelo assist for the Champions League one against, I cannot remember who, Dortmund. Dortmund, that was very nice. I mean, he scored all kinds of goals.
But he scored like 25 before Christmas, and I can't remember any of them standing out, which is a tribute to both the passes he receives and, as we've said before, it's the movement. It's that he's... There's a brilliant quote from Gary Lineker when he said, you know, people always ask me why I'm in the right place at the right time. And he said, it's because I'm in the right place all the time. And that's what Haaland seems to be able to do.
Damn.
He's just there. He's just there all the time. The goals against last week in the Champions League against Leipzig, it's just remarkable how often the ball bounces down and it's him swinging a foot or a leg or a chest or anything.
The one I can remember is there was a sort of Ibra-esque kind of flying kick. I can't remember who it was against, but he kind of got his left foot up to some absurd height and flicked it in.
I feel like that was Dortmund, but maybe I'm wrong. That was the Dortmund one, yeah.
I can't remember that much of it. I mean, okay. Clearly.
I'm glad that it fulfills my theory that you both remember the same goal.
Yeah. There you go. That's one.
But I like, even there's just something, even the way he takes penalties, he's just such a remarkable, like, physical specimen. There's something like demonic about the way he takes penalties, even, like the kind of intensity of it. And he spends so much of his time just making runs and not getting the ball, but doesn't ever seem to really get fed up. I mean, we've seen him getting fired up, you know, with particular opponents every now and again. But even though his sort of involvement in build-up play is minimal, you know, the fact that he's scoring goals means that he's doing exactly what he was, you know, bought in to do. And he does seem to be really enjoying himself as well. Like, there's no sort of, like, I mean, occasionally, but, you know, most of the time he's got a smile on his face, which is nice.
Yeah, he's just a cold-eyed, steel-toed killer of goals. Sheffield United, speaking of steel, 3-2, their victory over Blackburn. The winning goal was an absolute stormer from Tommy Doyle, himself on loan from Manchester City.
We haven't seen the board for the additional minutes. Back to Doyle out of his...
Wow, what a detail this is. Doyle's grandfathers, on both his mother's and his father's side, that's Mike Doyle and Glyn Pardoe, both won the FA Cup with Man City. We're in the same team in 1969.
Chances are, he's certainly not going to be playing the semi-final.
He's not going to be playing in the semi-final.
Paul Heckingbottom did say after the game there would have to be discussions about whether he can play.
Oh, could they waive it? Because he's on loan from City, is the issue.
I think technically they probably could, but I don't understand why they would.
It's the FA's decision.
Right, okay. But yeah, it would be very odd if they said, yeah, you know, his grandfather, 2 grandfathers, the grandfather clause, let's just waive it through. Let him play.
Yeah, I mean, I'm personally in favour of loanees playing whenever they want. It seems a bit rough that...
The Morientes rule.
Yeah, yeah, effectively. When he knocked out Real Madrid from the Champions League.
2003, 2004.
Yeah. Damn, you're good. Anyway, there you go. So they won't have him, but they had him here, and it was absolutely crucial in what was a storming game, which I didn't watch because I was busy doing Serie A. What happened?
Blackburn took the lead. They were pinned back, and then they took the lead again. And then Sheffield United scored a couple of times in the last 5 minutes. Blackburn, 10 minutes away from getting to Wembley, one of six teams in the Football League never to have played at the new Wembley.
All right.
James, off the top of your head, can you tell us who the other ones are?
Listener, do you know who the other five are? Tom?
I know Atkinson Stanley.
Yes,
one.
That's one. Daniel?
Rochdale.
No.
Crawley Town?
Yes, Crawley Town. Of course, Crawley Town. Three missing.
Salford would have played there.
Harrogate?
Yes.
Ooh.
No, not Harrogate, but it sounds a bit like it.
Halifax?
No.
What sounds like
Hartlepool? Hartlepool
does.
And Colchester and Ipswich are the other two. Hurrah. Well done, Leicester. So anyway, Sheffield United earn a spot against Man City, and good luck with that. You never know.
Yeah, Sheffield United's second in the Championship at the moment with Middlesbrough approaching from behind. But really, it was a surprisingly good season for them. I didn't think they would do this well. But.
Amazing. All right, well, while all that FA Cup stuff was going on, there was also a busy round of fixtures in the league, and that is where we're headed next.
This is the Totally Football Show, sponsored by LiveScore Bet. With Bet Builder from LiveScore Bet, you can combine markets from thousands of options to create your own bet on the biggest football fixtures in the Premier League, the Champions League, the EFL, and around the world. So if you think you can successfully pick the first goal scorer, the final score, the total number of corners, and whether there'll be a red card, then use Bet Builder from LiveScore Bet to make up to six selections and get a single bet with the combined odds. Or, if you can't make up your mind, you can choose from the pre-built quick bet options. Bet Builder from LiveScore Bet. Building a bet just got easier. Find out more at livescorebet.com or by downloading the LiveScore Bet app on Android and iPhone. It's over 18s only. Full account terms apply. And of course, please bet responsibly and be gambleaware.org.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman, and this week on the Athletic Football Podcast, we're bringing you a two-part special on the future of football. What will the expanded 48-team World Cup look like? And is it actually such a terrible idea? Plus, UEFA against FIFA, a Super League in disguise. How would you feel if your team became part of a multi-club model? There is a lot to get stuck into. Matt Slater, Adam Crafton and Laura Williamson will be with us. Just search for the Athletic Football Podcast wherever you listen.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Big weekend in the Premier League. The bottom nine, now separated after the weekend's action by just 4 points. Leeds were the only side down there to win. They had that 4-2 victory at Wolves. Saints drew with Spurs, coming from 3-1 down to tie that game. Conte took it well, though. Everton also drew. That was 2-2 at Chelsea. Todd Bowley took that well. Leicester got their first point away from home in a very long time. 1-1 at Brentford. Villa beat Bournemouth 3-0. And Palace, in their first post-Pat Vieira affair, lost 4-1 at Arsenal. Of course, Vieira, given the heave-ho by the Eagles on Friday, first thing, at 7 a.m. as he made his way to the training ground, that's brutal, he gets the call. And you'll have seen, listener, probably, that they're in talks to replace him with the man he replaced, Roy Hodgson. Wow. Our Mr. Palace, Dom Fifield, joins us now to discuss Pat's departure and potentially the biggest Roy twist since that press conference at the end of season three. How are you feeling about the news, Dom?
Which aspect of the news?
Well, all right, let's start with Patrick Vieira. Was it the right call?
Unfortunately, it was. And I say that with no great delight. This has been probably the managerial sacking at Crystal Palace that's caused the most upset amongst the supporters, because everybody wanted that appointment to work. The fit felt right. But any manager in the Premier League who wins one game in 16, regardless of the difficulties of the fixtures, and they were horrendous fixtures, is going to struggle to keep his job. And moreover, I think it was the listless attacking displays and the second half performances, you know, after he's got into the dressing room at half time, certainly at Brighton, you could say Villa recently, Forest before the World Cup. These were games where Palace had started brightly, conceded the goal, and for the second half were aimless, lacked a clear game plan to get back into the game. So I think when you look at that and you've got £150 million business effectively on the line and Premier League status is now in serious doubt, it does provoke change. So after one win in 16, yes.
All right. 11 of which, the last 11 of which had all been against top half opponents, as you were referencing. He did so well last season with Crystal Palace. What changed? A lot of people would suggest it was the club's decision to sell key players and not replace them.
Oh, look, culpability is shared on this completely. And actually, you might argue that he was sold a bit of a pup on Palace. Where the recruitment was so extensive by Palace's standards in the summer of 2021, the last two transfer windows have been a bit underwhelming, to be honest. He certainly couldn't play the type of football that he wanted to play, which was the sort of Conor Gallagher press from last season. And yeah, we will look back fondly on that season, but we should also remember that there was a run of, I think, 2 wins in 12 in the middle of that season, the first year in charge. And the run-in was excellent. And there were periods where Palace played some lovely football and they had a cup run that masked some of the deficiencies in the league. That hasn't been the case this time around. They lost players, as you say, and didn't replace them. I mean, there wasn't a massive outcry when Christian Benteke leaves for DC United, but they should have been because he wasn't replaced. If somebody goes out who is a factor in your team, whether it be off the bench or in the side on occasion, you need to replace him in the Premier League. And Palace just couldn't do that. And to be honest, I thought the business in January was fairly underwhelming as well. So he was dealt a poor hand with which to work. And that's been the reason. But unfortunately, as a head coach with a coaching staff that you've appointed and you've stuck by, you have to improve what's the players at your disposal.
Right.
I don't think there are many Palace players in that squad, possibly Michael Olise, who could look at this season and say they've actually improved as players. I think the rest of them have gone backwards.
So is Roy Hodgson very, very likely to take over? And is he going to be able to play that hand any better than Pat did?
I think he is very likely to take over. I think he is the option that the club will pursue. I'm aware that hasn't gone down well with the fan base.
And why is that?
Well, because I see it as a retrograde step, and it is. It looks regressive, going back to the man that whose football people were railing against a few years back, and now putting him back in charge with 10 games to go. But the reality is, when they appointed Patrick Vieira, it was all about evolution, and they thought they were building from a position of relative strength. That they're not now. It's not about evolution for the next 10 games. It will be in the summer when they make a permanent appointment. Or somebody on the with a long-term vision
and
a plan.
Did you do air quotes when you said
permanent?
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, I'm doing that all the time. Yeah, it's a nervous tick these days.
Yeah.
But it's not about evolution now. It's about keeping Palace in the division. It's their status after 10 years in this top flight is on the line. And if you are Steve Parrish or Josh Harris or David Blitzer, if you're those guys and you're worried about your investment and you're worried about where Palace, you know, the long-term project that is Crystal Palace Football Club in the Premier League, there is some logic in appointing the only man in your history who has kept the team in the division for 4 years.
All right. Barry Plummer says, if you were chairman of Palace, Dom, who would you appoint as our next manager for the long term and why?
Well, I would have a good look who's available in the summer.
Right.
I wouldn't look now for the long term because you're not going to find someone now.
Okay, yeah.
For the long term.
But you come the summer, Tom Fifield, DS at Selhurst Park, who are you picking up the phone to? Who are you flipping through your Rolodex to find?
I don't know. If they're a Premier League team, then I would look. I know they've looked at Roger Schmidt in the past. I think he might be someone that might be interesting for Palace. I'd be ambitious.
Yeah.
In the summer.
Right.
I don't think you have to be ambitious now. You just have to be pragmatic now and get somebody in that's going to keep you up. And of all the candidates out there, and just look through the list of available candidates on the assumption that Pochettino and Tuchel may not fancy it. You basically are looking at sort of Benitez stroke. I mean, I know Nick wrote a lovely piece about Benitez, but I suspect Rafa Benitez would want longer than 10 games in charge. Mm. Or Roy Hodgson.
All right. I know you've got to go and do important things, Dom, but Daniel's got a question for you.
Well, I just think it's funny that Dom mentions those out-of-work English managers, and it's Roy Hodgson, Tony Pulis, Sam Allardyce and Alan Pardew, all of which I think have managed Crystal Palace before in the Premier League. It's right. I initially thought this looks a really unambitious appointment. This looks like a backward step. But unless you think that Paddy McCarthy can see it through, then you have to go for a short-termist. And of those, Roy Hodgson somehow at 75 is probably the most Premier League relevant.
He's also the most Palace relevant because he knows the place. He's not coming in. If any of the other guys who haven't been there before come in, they might look at the club and think, wow, we might not even know where the training ground is. They might not know, you know, how the club functions day to day. And it is a club with its quirks. Roy Hodgson knows all those. I mean, I know a lot of this will boil down to the level of toxicity that is at the Leicester City game on the 1st of April, because there will be an outcry amongst the fan base if Roy is appointed. But if Palace want to stay in the division, then they're going to have to whip up some kind of atmosphere that's similar to that that Everton managed at Goodison Park last season. And people are just going to have to swallow it for the 10 matches. And it doesn't matter how ugly the football is. It really doesn't matter. It's about staying in the division.
It also gives Roy Hodgson a chance to finish his managerial career at Palace, which is what he should have done last time, only to then go on and take that Watford job, which is one of the worst decisions he's ever made.
Nice. So bringing it back home again.
Could be a nice little,
potentially in front of
spin.
A full house against Forest on the last day.
There you go. What could be better? As you wave goodbye to the Premier League and Roy Hodgson.
Dom, thank you so much for being with us today.
Pleasure.
Dom Fifield. All right, 2 days after this dramatic decision, Palace were, of course, in action at the Emirates, where they came a cropper at the hands of Arsenal 4-1. Daniel, you were there.
Yeah, and the one thing they hadn't done under Vieira was get hammered in any of those games. I think in those 11 games they'd not won after a 4-0 defeat to Spurs, there's not been more than a single goal in any of the games. They were sort of staying in games but not being able to find anything. And here they just kind of collapsed against an admittedly brilliant Arsenal team, and an Arsenal team for whom Gabriel Martinelli's goal just sort of sent a wave of relief, as if to say, OK, it's not all breaking. You can tell that the first goal of the Arsenal score in each game, there's this sort of wave of relief around the Emirates, and then everyone realises, like, OK, we can have some fun now. And that's exactly what Arsenal did. They were so much better than Palace. And you look at those creative players for Palace, and Zaha spent most of the game sort of imploring people to try and pass to him and having to take on three players. Eberechi Eze came on for Michael Olise, and they kind of gave a look to each other as if to say, like, good luck, mate. It's not very easy out there. There's just nothing. They were quite limp in midfield. They were missing Joachim Anderson, who I think is probably their best central defender. But yeah, it's looking a pretty bleak. The thing we should say, which Dom clearly references, they've now got, I think, 8 of the last 11 games against teams below them. So I think they will be okay.
Mm. Arsenal, when you talk about things that are giving their supporters cause for concern, how highly would William Saliba's injury figure?
I think he is the least. Yesterday after the game, Takehiro Tomiyasu was on crutches and in a knee brace, which suggests that his is a more long-term injury. And we should say that Ben White was brilliant yesterday at right back. I think Saliba's is more precautionary. He won't, I suspect, won't be playing over the international break. And I think the discussion is that he might well be fit for the first game after that, which would be perfect.
Mm, when they'll be playing Leeds. All right, Leeds, who had quite the game on Saturday when they went to Molineux and came away with a 4-2 win, but there was a definite wobbly bit when they were 3-0 up, and then that Johnny lob sparked what looked like being an improbable Wolves comeback.
Yeah, those last couple of weeks, I kind of thought that Javier Gracia, his intention was to make Leeds sort of functional, a proper relegation battler rather than this kind of chaotic mess. But Leeds won out in the end, and they were a chaotic mess in a good way this weekend. I think they definitely missed Tyler Adams, who is this kind of, we talked about João Paulinho at Fulham last week, he's this kind of tackling, interception machine. And without him, they just basically looked like they were playing without a midfield. And it worked for them. They had the worst chances than Wolves. They had fewer big chances than Wolves, and yet they scored 4 goals because Wolves can't really defend and don't bother marking you in the penalty area. And I think Wolves also lost their heads with the refereeing decisions. Julian Lopetegui he's falling into that trap of just blaming referees after every game without actually much introspection, at least publicly, of what's going wrong. They've lost to Bournemouth and Leeds at home now in the last few weeks, and they had 2 sendings off, one for a really rash challenge. I think Johnny lost his head, and then Mateus Nunes is sent off for dissent. It sounds like they're going to appeal that one. But then Lopetegui after the game talking about kind of decisions not being fair and Wolves having a history and almost like sort of bias against Wolves. And I just don't think it helps. I think you need to focus on yourself first. And the teams in that battle who are doing this, Forest or another, it's almost like they're getting obsessed with this idea that everything's against them, and that's almost like playing psychologically into how they play. And both of them lost at home this weekend.
Good Lord. And they're going to be facing each other when the Premier League returns for the international break. And
just on Nunes, did we see who the player trying to calm him down on the bench was? Diego Costa.
Nice.
Never a good sign.
Yeah, never a good sign when he's come on, you've taken it a bit far now, mate. Come on, let's just rein it in a little bit.
All right, I want to salute the supreme technical skill of Johnny with that remarkable volley.
I mean, he had a remarkable afternoon, and it's pretty rare that you score a kind of goal of the season contender and then almost break someone's leg. I mean, the challenge on Luke Ayling was one of the worst I've seen in years. Really, really ugly. Ends up, you know, sort of snuffing out any hopes of a Wolves comeback. But yeah, the goal itself was beautifully taken.
Certainly was. The other Wolves goal was quite remarkable as well, because it was scored by a striker. Nick, 374 days into Wolves' striker has fulfilled their purpose, but Mateus Cunha did it here.
Are we classifying him as definitely a centre-forward? Yeah, I don't know. These purposes, let's do it.
Yeah, Daniel's nodding.
If Daniel's nodding, then I'm prepared to accept
that.
Giving
his assent. Yeah. There you go. All right, so it's Wolves sharpening their teeth ahead of the trip to the City Ground to take on Forest when we return from the international break. When we return from the international break, will Antonio Conte still be in charge of Spurs? ... Wide eye emoji. We'll talk about Tottenham next.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
We're sponsored for this episode of the Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to The Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally. You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, sponsored by LiveScore Bet. You can get the latest football betting odds at livescorebet.com. It's over 18s only. Please bet responsibly and be gambleaware.org.
Ward-Prowse lines it up. Forster touches the crossbar. Here he comes. And he scores!
Oh, good penalty.
Third time lucky for James Ward-Prowse from the penalty spot. His seventh goal of the season.
Southampton 3, Tottenham 3, the game that sparked on Saturday that epic post-game pissed-off presser. We all saw it. If you didn't, listener, Conte said, "We are not a team. We're 11 players that go on the pitch. I see selfish players, players that don't want to help each other, don't put their heart into it. It's time to change this situation if Tottenham want to change." He said loads of other stuff as well. Anything else that was particularly vicious in there, or was that the gist of it?
There was a point where he basically reproduced the immortal Giorgio Chiellini, "It is the history of the Tottenham," post-match interview.
Yeah, but it was an angry version of "Lads, it's Tottenham."
Yeah, isn't it, really? And he is the manager of Tottenham. I mean, I think that for me was the most remarkable. We've seen managers criticise their own players. We've seen Tottenham managers criticise their own players. Hello, Jose Mourinho. But to rail against not just seemingly the owner of the club, but the whole culture of the club. I mean, he basically said what pundits have been saying about the problems at Spurs for years. Yeah. But when you are the manager of Spurs and therefore figurehead and spokesperson, you're not really supposed to.
Yeah. Would you have had him dressed in a hot dog suit saying, "We're all looking for the person who did
it"? Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, that was it. And this is a feature of Antonio Conte's, management, particularly, since he's been at Spurs, that he doesn't ever call himself into question. And I think while there might be some sympathy for the structural and cultural problems at Tottenham that he alluded to, if his football wasn't so absolutely appalling, you'd be minded to feel a bit more sympathy for him.
Yeah, the exit to Milan, of course, in the Champions League proceeding, there's a Milan side who promptly went and lost 3-1 at Udinese at the weekend, they're hardly the most irresistible force of all, and then letting a Saints side who are historically bad at scoring goals come back from 3-1 down, not the greatest. Sasuheinu says, "Was Conte right in his rant and does it matter?" Akhlef Hanif says, "Should Spurs punish Conte by keeping him in the job?"
That was Gary Neville's solution, kind of. Right. Make him stay and make him do his job. I mean, I can't see how this gets any better. We Dom spoke about the difficulty of getting managers in at this stage of the season. I suspect he probably will just stay in his job. The thing that annoyed me most about what he did is that he kind of hung everyone out to dry and then clarified later that I was only talking about the players, not the people who are paying me. So don't worry about it. It's only the people who are responsible for this who are to blame, not you guys who pay me and I want you to keep me in my job until the end of the season. I mean, yeah. I watched Tottenham in 180 minutes of the Milan tie, and they failed to try and attack. Never mind attack, failed to try to attack for about 155 minutes of that, at which point, 2 minutes later, a defender charges out and gets sent off. If all of that is on the players, and that's all by design, fair enough. If not, then it's the job of the manager to stop that happening. And his lack of acceptance of culpability and his self-preservation. And he did exactly the same at Chelsea, we have to say. He spent £240 million, or had £240 million spent on him as Spurs manager. It's a lot of money at Spurs. Mm.
He's accusing the players of being selfish while also this sort of naked act of self-preservation. So they're just kind of following his lead.
Yeah.
Jack Pitbrook wrote a piece about this, and he had quite a nice line in it where he says, "Usually when managers lose the dressing room, it's because the players give up on them. This is a rare example of the opposite, the dressing room losing the manager."
Right. Saints, though, what a stirring comeback for them, and a point that could prove absolutely crucial come the end of the season. Lovely to see Theo Walcott back at the heart of things.
Yeah, he's now 5-yearly cycle of he got a goal and assist in this game. He also did it. The last time he did it was in 2018, and the time before that was in 2013. So I don't know where he will be playing in 2028, but he will score a goal and will contribute an assist in one of those games.
Southampton's last four, I mean, I still probably think they'll go down, but the last four games, they beat Leicester, drew the United, lost at Brentford, which, you know, can happen, and then came back from 3-1 down against Spurs. So there is some kind of, there's life there under Salas.
They are still bottom of the table, a point behind Bournemouth, who are 19th, but the entire 1, 2, 3, 4 bottom seven are separated by 3 points. And as mentioned before, only a further point takes you up to Palace and Wolves, who are in 12th and 13th. Just incredible.
I mean, there is no mid-table in the Premier League this season. The top half of the table, and actually if you go down to Villa in 11th, you're either in the title race, you're in the mix of the Champions League, or you're aiming for Europe. And then from Palace in 12th down to Southampton in 20th, you're trying to avoid the drop. There's no in-between. It is the season of extremes.
It would be glorious chaos that I could enjoy if my team wasn't right in the middle of it all.
Right, embrace that. Embrace it, Nick. Just as Chelsea and Everton supporters are probably doing, they had that extraordinary 2-2 draw Saturday tea time. Heard Todd Bowley's reaction earlier on to what must have felt like a bit of a setback for Chelsea after a lot of people felt they turned the corner against Dortmund, things clicking into place. But how about this point for Sean Dyche and Everton going to Stamford Bridge, coming from behind twice? That doesn't happen often, does it?
It's a sort of classic Dyche game, really. Doing what I think everyone expected him to do when he eventually took over some club, which was, you know, stay in games and then threaten from set pieces, which they did for the first goal and then the second goal. I mean, without wishing to pivot back to Chelsea, quite sort of embarrassing defending by Koulibaly. So it's quite a strange career because he seemed to be the sort of one of the better defenders in Serie A for what, about 7 or 8 years, constantly linked with moves away. He then eventually gets the move away when he's 31, only for the team he leaves to promptly run away with Serie A and him to be embarrassed by some kid who was playing with Sunderland for the first half of this season.
Right. I mean, so many questions and so many talking points that spin off that. Not least the fact that it is curious how some players suddenly post-30 to have that dramatic fall-off. But that post-Sunderland player, Ellis Sims, has Sean Dyche just found himself the striker that his Everton side so desperately needed?
I don't think so. I think Ellis Sims is still very raw. Everton called him back because Dominic Calvert-Lewin was injured for the foreseeable, not, I think, because they were intending to start Ellis Sims every game. It might be if he can be a presence, then that will be enough for Sean Dyche. But yeah, I mean, he's certainly got the pace to beat Kalidou Koulibaly, which is probably a backhanded compliment from the way he's played this season. I mean, on him, very briefly, Chelsea gave him a 4-year deal on $160,000 a week, which, those 4 years feel quite long when he turns 32 in June and is playing like he is. So, yeah, those problems stacking up. But I don't think Ellis Sims is a striker, and so I think Dyche likes Demarai Gray as that kind of false nine, dropping back and almost making it just a full midfield up there and then rotating positions and scoring goals from set pieces.
Mm. And also, the positive thing for Everton is that although they remain without a sort of reliable goal-scoring centre-forward, they are scoring goals from other areas. They're scoring goals from set pieces, or Seamus Coleman pops up with a goal, or Dwight McNeil pops up with a goal. So, you know, obviously the absence of Dominic Calvert-Lewin is unfortunate, and I'd agree with Daniel that, as you know, as exciting as Ellis Sims' contribution was on Saturday, you can't expect him to do that every game. But I think particularly with the improvement in terms of their organisation at attacking set pieces, there's nothing to suggest that Everton can't continue doing this until the end of the season and end up, you know, managing to keep their heads above water.
I think even though they are very much in there, I think they're of those teams in that kind of mesh of clubs, they're the ones who I'd be kind of most confident about staying up.
Interesting. They are 2 points clear of the bottom three at the moment, all the way up in 15th. Danny, you've got a ruler you're waving in the air. Is that for some cogent point or just...
No.
Yeah,
no.
All right then. Okay, a disappointing week for the Blues, because of course on Friday they were handed what's got to be the hardest draw imaginable in European football. For their Champions League quarter-final, they got to take on Real Madrid, the holders. And if they get past them, well, it's only the small matter of Man City or Bayern.
They beat Real Madrid in the Champions League a couple of years ago, though. So.
Yeah, that's true.
What relevance that has to anything, I don't know.
No, but I mean, yeah, it's fair.
Yeah.
And then remember that time they won the whole thing under Di Matteo.
Yeah.
Away at Bayern in their own stadium.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Oh, and N'Golo Kante's back. He was on the bench anyway.
Yeah, I'd completely forgotten about N'Golo Kante, which is a huge shame. I don't know if this kind of pattern of injuries is a kind of thing because he just played so much for basically 5 years straight in title races and as heartbeats of the club that's just caught up with him. But he's a wonderful footballer to watch in that we started the show with it, but like Saka, he kind of has this sort of, in everything he does, he seems to appreciate how lucky he is to be doing it. He's probably got football, the Premier League's best smile, in N'Golo Kante. So yeah, hopefully he can be back for the foreseeable.
Not to completely destroy the mood at mention of N'Golo Kante's smile, but there was a really interesting piece about him in France Football the weekend before last and the problems he's had with various agents representing him and falling out with each other, and a very murky situation with regard to his entourage. And there was a detail in this story that at some point he was back home in Suresnes in the suburbs west of Paris and had a gun pulled on him
by
an associate of an agent who had some kind of beef at having been sort of sidelined during one of the deals, either the deal that took him from, I think it must have been the deal that took him from Leicester to Chelsea or the deal that took him to Leicester. And just basically there is a whole network of agents and advisors kind of swarming around Conte and kind of like polluting his off-pitch life. And it's something that I don't think has really been picked up on all that much in this country. And clearly, we know that he's been absent because of injuries in recent times. But the suggestion in this piece, at least, was that this situation has been weighing down on him quite heavily as well. And he was sort of invited to, comment for this piece. He said, oh, you know, everything's fine. There's nothing to worry about. But I think there are sort of ongoing, you know, tensions and wrangles and issues there that his family have been sort of swept into, and it's quite an unpleasant situation.
Boy, never saw that in Monsieur 15% or whatever that show is called.
Mm. Oh yeah, well, indeed.
Dark. Okay. Hey, we'll have more Euro views on the Continental Game and Friday's draw for the Champions League, Europa League and Europa Conference League in Tuesday's Totally Football Show, which is going to be a busy one. Because we're also going to try and find time to mention the Rome Derby, the Derby d'Italia, El Clasico in La Liga, De Clasico in the Netherlands, which Rafa might have called De Topper on Thursday's pod. It's not. That's Ajax PSV Tour. And also, hello, Bayern losing in the Bundesliga and PSG getting done 2-0. Isn't that right, Tom? PSG getting done 2-0 by Stade Rennais.
Yeah, and Kim Kardashian was present.
Oh yeah,
she was in the posh seats. She turned up at Parc des Princes to see the spectacle. What she saw was a PSG at their latest, post Champions League exit low ebb, with a back three of 17-year-old centre back El Shaddai Bichiabu, central midfielder Danilo Pereira, and aging Spanish left back Juan Bernat playing as a right-sided centre-back in a back three.
Mm.
And actually created quite a lot of chances. Mbappe had about three or four shots saved by Steb Mondanda. And Rennes scored a couple of quite nicely taken goals. And it is just Groundhog Day. PSG are out of the Champions League. This season's project has failed. They're also out of the Coupe de France. But they've got enough margin for error at the top of the table that they can afford to lose points every now and again, because Marseille and Lens probably aren't going to catch them.
Mm.
And you sort of, you know, you change them the names, you change the name of the coach, you change the identity of which celebrity.
You're going on a Conte-esque rant, aren't you?
At the Parc des Princes this week. But it is just... PSG are having
this. This is the history. PSG this is the history.
It is the history of the PSG.
And surely it's only leading to one thing: Conte taking over at PSG, and you know, having this rant in French.
I would love to see that so much.
Well, I mean, yeah. this is something for the Europod maybe. But yeah. where, assuming Conte is going to leave Spurs, yeah. where does he go?
Not Italy, next? Says James Horncastle.
Well, this is the thing. He's sort of burned bridges all over.
Well,
the place.
I think it's more that he comes with a hefty price tag, both in terms of his salary and also his shopping list.
And he still whines even
and
after
still
that.
Whines.
Yeah.
Yeah, but usually you get a good winning season out of him. Inter certainly did.
Yeah.
Poor old Spurs, who didn't even get that, but then it is the history. We've got some other games of the Premier League which we could discuss. They are Nottingham Forest losing 2-1 at home to Newcastle. A brace there for Alexander Isak. Aston Villa, meanwhile, continuing their excellent form under Unai Emery with a 3-0 win over Bournemouth. And Brentford, who've been on a bit of a wobble recently, allowing Leicester a rare point away from home in a 1-1 draw. What do you think, Daniel?
Of those three the games, the thing I'd like to point out is that David Brooks played in the Premier League for the first time since his stage 2 Hodgkin lymphoma diagnosis, I think in October 2021. Mm. So he had kind of 7 months of treatment, got back cancer-free in May 2022, and since then has been working for kind of full fitness and finally came back onto the pitch in March 2023, which is a pretty amazing ordeal and journey. He doesn't need mine or anyone else's congratulation because he'll be on top of the world himself, but it is just lovely to see him back.
Yeah, horrible disease and an incredible recovery. Amazing to see him back playing at the highest level again.
Yeah, I mean, you know, fantastic news for Wales. You know, when David Brooks first emerged, he looked like he was going to become part of this current generation of slightly younger players who are going to lead the national team into what would hopefully be a glorious future. And such a talented player and quite an unusual sort of player. You know, someone who can play as a number 10, can play off the right-hand side, lovely left foot, really inventive, like genuine, top level creativity, and yeah, you know, he's obviously missed out on international football during the period that he's not been playing, and although he's not in the current Wales squad, understandably, you know, if he can get some football under his belt, there's definitely, you know, room for him in this squad. I mean, you know, this international break will be the first one since the retirement of Gareth Bale, since the international retirement of Joe Allen, and mm-hmm. Wales are rebuilding. And if David Brooks could become part of that, he's definitely good enough to be part of that. It could be really exciting.
Who have you got, Tom, in the international break?
Croatia and Latvia.
Okay.
So Croatia, tricky. Latvia, tricky in their own way, but yeah, Probably slightly less tricky.
Okay, and this is the start of your Euro qualifying campaign, as it is indeed for all the nations. England taking on Italy down in Naples on Thursday. We'll talk much more about all of that in Thursday's pod. Nick, would you rather discuss your own plans to go to see Armenia take on Turkey in this international break, or Forest losing 2-1 at home to Newcastle?
Tough call. Well, the one thing I will say about Forest is it kind of touches on something that we were talking about before. Mm. After the game, the official Forest Instagram account posted something. It says, a crucial decision in a crucial match, and we've been badly let down by the wrong call.
Mm.
It's just... Was it
a manager's selection, was it, or something?
No, referee. Some kind of nebulous refereeing decision. Mm. And it's not really the point, but Forest have been complaining about refereeing decisions, and this kind of seems to go to the top of the club. The owner has a history of whinging about these things in Greece as well. And, not really the point, but in the last two games, Forest have been the beneficiary of some pretty, not necessarily honking mistakes, but the two big controversial calls, like Elliot Anderson's disallowed goal on Friday night, probably should have been given. Everton possibly should have had a penalty in the previous home game. But it feeds into the what Daniel was talking about earlier on, of just this kind of embarrassing paranoia that seems to be kind of endorsing the embarrassing paranoia of fans all over the place.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's have a palate cleanser then. Why Armenia, Turkey?
For anyone who doesn't know about the geopolitical history between
right
Armenia and Turkey, it goes back over 100 years. There was a genocide from the Turkish people against about 1.5 million Armenians. Turkey has never acknowledged that it's genocide. I think they're the only country in the world who has never acknowledged this. And needless to say, there has been beef since. I don't want to diminish this, but ever since Armenia became an independent country in 1991, despite them having a land border, there's been no or very limited diplomatic relations. That seems to be thawing a bit at the moment. But the two countries are playing each other for it will be the third and fourth time in the in their history. Previously played each other in 2008 and 2009. Mm. So yeah, it's a kind of.
How did those go? Were they?
Turkey won both of them,
but were they relatively calm affairs?
They kind of were. At the time, they were trying. The two countries were trying to kind of. There's some sort of international rapprochement, and they used those games as kind of diplomatic.
The Infantino approach.
Yeah, hands across the divide kind of thing, and a tentative accords were reached, which then immediately collapsed shortly after that. So this time they're not using the football games in any kind of official diplomatic sense because of those reasons, because they didn't want it to be associated with the failures of before. But yes, I'm possibly going to see this game.
All right. Well, good luck if you do.
Diplomatic strings can be pulled.
Mm. If you are listening in the British Embassy in Armenia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Daniel, you're heading down to Naples. Good luck with that trip. I'm sure you'll have a delightful time.
Yes. I mean, we should say that after the issues between Frankfurt fans and in Naples last week, there's a story in the Times on Monday morning to say that there's a tradition whereby England fans and the fans of the team they're playing have a kind of lunchtime pre-game match. And this has had to be cancelled this time because of threats sent over email to the England fans group, which is probably a new low, I think.
Mm. That is a shame. That is a shame. Well, I hope you have a good trip anyway. We'll be talking, as I say, more about the internationals in Thursday's show, although I won't actually be there because I'm heading off on a trip of my own. But super. I will be here.
Where are you off to, James?
Well, I'm going to Tokyo, actually.
Ooh, lovely.
Just a little trip.
An international break.
Cool.
Yeah. Interesting. But I am here for Tuesday's show, in which Rafa and Jules and James and Alvaro will be discussing all that craziness in the continent. For today, many, many thanks for Tom. What a brilliant replacement you proved to be for Amitai Winehouse.
Thanks, I'm glad that Amitai's opinions have been so well received.
So well received. Nick Miller, thank you very much for being with us today. And Daniel Story, too. Listener, thank you especially. And producer Charlie. And do join us on Tuesday and Thursday and speak to you soon.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by LiveScore Bet. Get the latest football betting odds at livescorebet.com. It's over 18s only. Please bet responsibly and begambleaware.org.
The Athletic.